There's a river flowing in my soul.
Ray Saldana helped us begin with the experience of one young person. What becomes possible when an adult sees the whole context, earns trusts, and coordinates support around real needs and aspirations. Our next conversations ask a related question. What does it take to understand the child well enough to choose, deliver, and adapt the right support? Catherine Bradshaw and John Lockman bring decades of research on prevention, school climate, aggressive and disruptive behavior, and an evidence-based intervention coping power. John opens with a point that sounds simple, but carries his years of research behind it. What we see in the moment is only the surface of behavior. Underneath is a history and an ecology, patterns of emotional arousal, how a child interprets threat, learned expectations, family stress, peer dynamics, classroom composition, neighborhood conditions, and the child's capacity to calm down once their stress is activated. A response that addresses only the behavior in front of us can miss both what is driving it and what would actually help change it. Catherine brings her deep experience studying how schools support effective interventions at scale. Her work asks how schools move beyond isolated programs toward multi-tiered systems that select, support, align, and improve evidence-based practice, and she attends as much to the system around an intervention, the leadership, the data, coaching, and staff climate, as to the intervention itself. Together, Catherine and John push back on two common mistakes: assuming one program fits every child, and assuming a proven program stays effective no matter who delivers it or under what conditions. They also connect directly back to Ray's story. Mrs. Reyes did not respond to a category called student need. She responded to Ray as a particular person in a particular family and community context. Catherine and John help us understand the science and the implementation support required to make that kind of responsiveness systematic rather than exceptional. As you listen, hold this question: how do we use evidence without becoming formulaic, and individualized support without losing the structure that makes strong practice possible? John and Catherine, welcome. This episode focuses on a central challenge for schools and communities: how to align services and supports in ways that respond to the diversity of contexts and the individuality of children's strengths and needs, both in the moment and over time. Your collective work offers an unusually rich way to examine that challenge, beginning with Coping Power's contextual social cognitive model, a way of understanding behavior in relationship to how children interpret social situations, regulate emotions, and develop within families, schools, peer groups, communities, and broader social contexts, and are reinforced by them. That model is also relevant to the entire podcast series because it helps us connect what happens within a young person to the relationships, environments, and systems that can support or impede learning and thriving. John, let's begin with coping power itself. Although coping power is often described as an intervention for children with aggressive and/or disruptive behavior, coping power's underlying model is much broader. The model locates a child's behavior within an ecology that includes the child's emotional arousal and cognitive systems where they interpret inputs, family relationships, peer relationships, school experiences and climate, neighborhood conditions, and larger social inequalities. Could you unpack that model and show us how it can change what adults think about when they are looking at a child who is struggling, rather than just simply responding to the surface behaviors that they see?
Yes. So, of course, Coping power and anger coping before that really began with the focus on that surface behavior. There was a clinical push. We had children who had lots of problems with aggressive behavior. They were coming into clinics, so we were trying to figure out how to handle them. So you start with that. And then that led to thinking about what it is within the children themselves. What are the ways that they think? How do they handle their emotions? That kind of thing that are related to that behavior. And then it expanded as we developed coping power into thinking about these contextual factors. And of course, the clearest one, I think the one that we all know about or think about when we're thinking about children's behavior is within the family. And there is extensive research that's gone on for 40, 50 years now that talks about how different types of strategies or parenting that parents have are related to the development of aggressive behavior and to the maintenance of that behavior. So, parents who are less warm, less positive, harsher, more inconsistent have children who have more aggressive behavior. It's a complex issue, though, because as children become more disruptive and have more problems, parents often over time become less warm and become harsher. So it's not a static relationship. It's actually a very dynamic relationship. And it's also dynamic in the sense that for these parents, where we see these kinds of strategies, we know now that for many of these parents, they have their own issues. A lot of research on how caretaker depression, maternal depression, affects children's behavior. And it affects children's behavior because it affects parenting. So parents become more inconsistent the more depressed they become. So that factor, you can't just go in and change parenting. You have to think about what are the factors that are at the parents' level that contribute to that. Marital conflict being another important factor that in diary studies, we know that the more conflict that happens at one point in the day leads to harsher parenting later that day. So it's a very clear. So we're very concerned about the family, and which is why within coping power, we have a parent component that tries to address many of these issues with them. In terms of context, the neighborhood has a big effect on children. We know that children growing up in poor neighborhoods have more behavior problems over time. It affects everything, affects things like brain development. So it's a very complicated risk factor. And we also know that children who are growing up in neighborhoods with high rates of crime, violent crime, are more likely, the more they experience that in one year, the more they're aggressive they're going to become the next year. So those are broad factors. We know that they're out there. We cannot change them with coping power, but we know that they affect that child's behavior in the moment. The children's peer relationships and their involvement in what's happening at school are also important contexts. And at the school level, it's the relationship with the teachers, but also obviously the relationship with the peers that has a big effect on their behavior. So we've seen in some of our own research that if you have a child who has a certain level of aggressive behavior, and in the next school year, they move into a classroom that's densely populated with even more aggressive kids, they're going to become more aggressive. And then conversely, if they move into a classroom that's less densely populated with other aggressive kids, they become less aggressive. So the power of that peer group is present. And for the kids that we work with, we're very attentive to whether or not, because of their aggressive behavior, they become rejected from their peer group. From the larger peer group, which also typically suggests that there's some social skill deficits for that child. And then as the children move along and they begin to move out of elementary school into middle school, they encounter what is really the most risky risk factor at that time period, which is development. So once they move, they made that transition into adolescence. These other risk factors are still there. We're still concerned about parenting, so forth. But these issues about children's placement and connection to and being influenced by deviant peers is huge. So what does all that do? It affects what you described, David. So We then think about how these contexts affect what's happening within the child and how they perceive their social world. So that's our focus is on how they think about their social world, how they think about how they're going to respond to that social world. And for the children we work with, especially the ones who have a lot of reactive aggression, they misperceive what's going on. They're more likely to think that other people, other kids, or teachers, or the parents are being harsher to them, more hostile to them than they really are if we had an observer in that situation. So they have a misperception, they misappraise that situation. And as they do, there's the sympathetic nervous system activation that jumps right away, right? So they're feeling threatened and their body reacts and they become very aroused. And for the kids we work with, not only are they do they tend to be hyper aroused at the sympathetic nervous system level, but they have difficulty at the parasympathetic nervous system level to dampen that back down. So they get stirred up and they stay stirred up, unlike other children. So all of that, the misperception, this anger arousal, emotional arousal that's taking place, then affects the child's ability to think in a rational, deliberate way about what can I really do? What are my options here? What are my possibilities? And what's the likely consequences of each of those options? So all that gets colored by these problems they experience at the beginning. And the coping power of child component then is designed to have an impact on these kind of factors, on their perceptions of others, on their problem solving. And in more recent work, we've focused a lot on also on their schemas. So what happens as part of what happened in that situation where you think somebody's going to be out to get you is that you're relying on the schemas you've developed over time in your relationships with other people. And they can become very impermeable. So you're not able to take in new information. So we try to work on issues related to schemas and bias in thinking with them as well.
John, in his book, Emotional Intelligence, Dan Goleman talks about emotional hijacks. One of the things that I have learned from your work in coping power is there's a cognitive hijack as well that is happening, and you're dealing with both of those processes that are very important. I think also what you described about the power of peer groups and what happens when young people encounter different peer groups, which also is the work of John Coey, who you had worked with in Fast Track and so forth, really points to one of the reasons why one may want comprehensive school-wide interventions, even if one's thinking about one individual child, because one needs to inter affect the peers and how they interact with that child. That underlies the logic of the good behavior game that the late Shep Kellum studied for so many years, that really again showed the impact of what happens when you are surrounded by young people who either will reinforce your appropriate behaviors or reinforce your inappropriate behaviors.
David, along those lines, one of the really interesting studies that John had done with Tom DeShawn really addresses this issue more directly about group interventions relative to an individual. It was one of the particular adaptations of coping power that might be particularly interesting to chat a little bit about. I don't know if John, you want to mention something about that, and then we can talk about school-wide and classroom-wide.
That's great, Catherine. I think it is so important, is what will keep on coming up during the podcast series is the problematic nature of exclusionary discipline, which has, among other things, iatrogenic effects, which I think John will be talking about in terms of the work that he had done and so forth. So please do so, John.
Yeah, we started out early on with anger coping, which is the predecessor for coping power, working with children in small groups. And partly that's for very practical reasons and in clinical settings, because we were at that time working in Dallas, Texas, and very poor sections of Dallas. And we had some pediatric clinics that I was part of that were located literally within housing projects. And so we were getting many children being referred to us who had problems with aggressive behavior from teachers and from parents. And it was we weren't able to do all the behavioral parent training or family therapy we wanted at that time. So we had to work, think about a different way to work with some of these children. We began to use small group work with these children. And then that's continued on and through coping power. And it's certainly advantages for group work with these children, very clear. Part of it is that you can reach more children, obviously, but you can also do things differently in a group. You can have peer role playing. So it's a more realistic kind of role play with them where kids can practice skills as they're learning them. And then in a well-functioning group, there is this great opportunity for peer social reinforcement. So what we're talking about here is that during this period of time, kids are very open and vulnerable to peers, but if the peers are reinforcing you in a positive way, that's a really good thing, right? So there are those sides. But we were also aware that from very early on, that if you're running a group of five or six children, that there might be three or four that really progress nicely, one or two that are didn't at all, and probably at least one that got worse somewhere during that work. So it was a lot of variability. So that led Tom DeShawn and I to talk a lot about coping power. So the overall findings for coping power using the small group effect approach was that the program is effective. It's not that the overall program was iatrogenic. But we had this concern about some kids. We developed a study. We randomized kids to either be in a group or be seen individually. Exactly the same program. We had to adjust the individual a bit. So the role playing now is with the therapist and so forth. But it's really exactly the same aims and objectives. The only thing that's different here is format. And what we found, looking through a 1 year follow-up, the very first study, was that according to parents, they thought the kids were improving and improving relatively similarly in both conditions, both group and individual. But for teachers, that was not the story. Teachers really perceived the kids who had been seen individually to have improved markedly more than in their externalizing behavior problems than did the children in the group. So that was pretty clear. The main means that kind of individual delivery of this kind of intervention is important. It's very much like what Al Kasdan talked about back in the, oh, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, was very involved in some of the early research on cognitive behavioral interventions for children who are much like the ones that we work with. And a lot of his work was treatment oriented rather than necessarily school-based. But it involved working with the parents. So there's behavioral parent training going on. And there was problem solving work and cognitive behavioral work with the kids. He started out in a program, his program had group work with the kids. But then in a series of studies, he found that the children who were seen one to one did significantly better than the kids who were seen in group. And so that led him to change his program, his clinical program over time, became more individualized. So he's had big effect actually on the field and on my thinking. And then what we've done is to try to think about, okay, we're not going to throw out the groups. So what kind of children are most likely to be susceptible to negative effects in groups and should be then thought about as good candidates for individual therapy? And so we've looked through several different what we think of as kind of markers or indicators. One of the clearest at the very beginning was poor behavioral inhibition. So the kids who are very impulsive have very poor self-control, who look like ADHD kids without meds and running around. So that kind of behavioral inhibition, if kids are very high in that, they don't do as well in the group. And they do really nicely when seen individually. We then wanted to look at some issues related to emotion regulation. How does that predict who's going to be in there or not? In this study, we relied on physiological measures. So we have skin conductance for sympathetic nervous system and heart rate variability. The parasympathetic, so the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. So these are physiological markers of the fight flight system that we think about. And for children who are really reactive, have a lot of reactive aggression, so they're easily stimulated. They jump to the threat and they get stirred up. We have skin conductance measures. We can see that happening very rapidly. Parasympathetic system, we look at through what's called respiratory sinus arrhythmia. So it's a method that was developed by Steve Porges and involves looking at heart rate variability. And it's an indicator of your ability to slow down that arousal. So it's your body's ability to regulate down from that. It's not just all thinking, I better cool off or something like that, but your body actually is able to begin to do that. So some individuals from this kind of study are not good at that. Their body's not good at that, right? And so you have to build in more band-aids to help them to manage that. Within Coping Power, we have a toolbox of some fairly elementary, quick things that kids can do, including breathing, that can help them to slow down and then allow the parasympathetic system to activate as much as it can. Is to dampen their arousal. So they're faced with a variety of things that stir them up in the group and they don't settle well. And they're very prone to then not improving. But you see them in individual coping power and they do fine. They do very well. It's removed that group context. And then the other issue we've looked at in several ways. One is actually in an interesting way, we had some marker candidate, like genetic markers, as part of a study. And so we were looking at oxytocin receptor genes. And we found that children who had the G allele on a receptor gene, so that means that you're producing lots of oxytocin, lots of social bonding, right? So we think of that as a really good thing. And it's really good for maternal child bonding, good for lots of things. But if you had high levels of that G allele, then actually you don't do as well in the group. And that surprised us a little bit, right? But you're better off being seen individually. And then we had another study that's just come out this year where we were looking at kids' acceptance with their peers using sociometric measures, and a very similar finding that the kids who are most popular have the most social skill actually do better seen individually rather than in the group. Why is that? It's this issue that the kids who are very oriented towards their peers are very much influenced by their peers in that group. So there's more disruption, that kind of thing, but they're also very prone to seeking and wanting social reward from their peers. And if their peers are not very regulated, that's what they're going to get reinforced for. And of course, there's lots of modeling going on in the group, or could be, of deviant behavior and deviant talk. So, in a kind of counterintuitive way, those kids who have the most social skill, you actually often want to be very careful about and think about seeing them elsewhere. Now, do I think these are hard and fast indicators? I don't, because I think there's other factors. I think if we are working with a child who's pretty emotionally dysregulated, but within the first session or two or three, we can see that this child's trying to have a positive engagement with the therapist, is engaging, trying to engage in therapy. A lot of times that you can build on that. And you have to tailor what you're doing in the session and all that kind of thing with that child in mind, but the child can be okay. If you don't have that engagement and you have some of these risk factors, then I think it's better to be seen individually.
John, what you just described is very important for our listeners because it really talks about why it's important not just to intervene, but to look at the data from your interventions and figure out what's working for whom and what's not working. And what I also hear in your story, including your interviews and Alan Kasdan's work, is the importance of also listening to the individual child. So it's not just using a screening mechanism, but it's listening. So you are able to identify this young person's strengths and needs and figure out what tends to work best or not. Am I hearing you correctly?
Oh, that's very much true. Yes, we're very attentive to strengths. So there's very few kids who are all negative. And so we want to build on those. And we want to build a sense of self-efficacy for these children over time. So as the program builds and gets nearer the end, we do a lot of focus on what are your strengths and what are your strengths for you, or the things you can build on.